motion.
Good morning.
Let
me get started. I call the LCC Preparedness for Terrorism and Disasters Working Group together again after something of a break. First thing we need to do is approve the minutes. So I'm looking for a motion to that effect. Mr. Forte?
Motion to approve.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Minutes are approved. We're going to start with the overview of public health and go straight to Dr. Osterholm. Please, if you can sit at the table and officially identify yourself for the record.
Just hitting that screen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Osterholm. I'm a professor in the School of Public Health and a professor in the medical school at the University of Minnesota. I direct the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and the NIH-supported Minnesota Center of Excellence in Influenza Research and Surveillance. My prior history is known to some of you here. I spent 24 years in the Minnesota Department of Health. Part of that time as a state epidemiologist, and I've been at the University of Minnesota since 2001 as the director of the SIDREP. Shortly after the events of 9/11, Secretary Tommy Thompson asked me if I would assist in his efforts to respond to the terrorism events of that time period, and so I split my time from 2001 to 2005 on an intergovernmental purchase agreement and was a special advisor to Secretary Thompson, and for 6 months in 2002 served on the three-person management team that ran the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, current and the previous director. So hopefully today my comments will reflect what I would consider to be a variety of different experiences around the area of public health. Now, to begin with, I won't be able to cover an overview of public health threats in this time period we have allotted because, in fact, you could spend a large part of the day. Let me just begin by, first of all, telling you what public health is not, which may be helpful. It is very natural anytime we think of disaster preparedness or we think of a catastrophic event to think of red lights and sirens. While red lights and sirens are very important in the response to a number of such events, they typically do not reflect major public health issues, meaning the health of the general public across the whole population. As we saw, for example, and as with Rocco here today, we've heard many times the absolutely spectacular response that this state and specifically the city of Minneapolis put forward with the Interstate 35 bridge collapse, that is a very different situation than a large meningitis outbreak in a community that may be going on for weeks and may require us to actually bring in resources from a number of different jurisdictions that have nothing to do with red lights and sirens. So that in part, we have to begin to understand what the public health system is. It's not that. A bomb going off today in any one of our buildings would be a disastrous event. But in fact, it would happen. We would go into recovery immediately. It would be isolated geographically, and the impact would be limited to that zone of the explosion. On the other hand, if someone attacked our food supply today, by the time that we actually understood that we were under attack, we could have many thousands of people in all counties of the state who were victims of that particular attack, and there'd be many unknowns. No one would know where it came from, where it was at, where it was going, and would require immediate and thorough investigation, as well as trying to deal with a very wide variety of different clinical needs throughout the state. So public health really deals with the issue of the public's health, and typically we think more often in the area of infectious diseases. Today I think that it's fair to say that the infectious disease picture, which we will focus on today, really can be broken down in, I believe, three different categories of types of diseases. The first are those which we routinely expect to happen, which are really works of Mother Nature, but can involve whole communities. I mentioned before the issue of meningitis, a bacterial disease that infects the brain and the blood systems of typically otherwise healthy individuals. Many in this room recall quite vividly the outbreak that we had in Mankato, Minnesota some years ago, where we had 10 cases of this. One student died. And over a period of several days, we, as the Minnesota Department of Health, along with its assistance from a number of local county health agencies as well as other state agencies, vaccinated 30,000 residents of the community of Mankato in order to try to bring that outbreak to an end. Today we're going to see more of those kinds of outbreaks as the kinds of diseases we see expand. Today we hear often about things like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, this newly resistant type of Staph aureus, which is causing increasing concerns. Those are the typical kind of things that don't often make the paper in a big way, but they require a tremendous number of resources to be able to first detect them, second of all respond to them, and third be able to then make sure that the community is appropriately aware of what these issues are and what they mean. That's the first kind. The second kind, which I would call catastrophic events of the first order, those are the kinds of events that would most likely be typified by a bioterrorism event. They do not have to always be large in number. I would argue that the 20-some cases of anthrax that occurred following the 9/11 event came close to bringing down the U.S. Postal System as well as a number of other well-honed institutions of our society. It clearly was not in relationship to the impact of the number of deaths or the actual number of cases. It's the terror, the fear, and the panic that is associated with those. On the other hand, they could be a disaster event. Today, someone using standard off-the-shelf equipment could literally lay down a line of anthrax spores from somewhere near Shakopee up to Maple Grove and readily infect well over 3 million people in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. That, unfortunately, may sound far-fetched, but as we've now come to realize with the investigation following the 2001 anthrax situation, we still don't know who did that. We know that they made a hell of a weapon with what they had, and we do know that today there are commercially available dual-use items for that. In one of my other roles, I serve on the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity, a White House appointed position that is actually looking at and trying to respond to what we call dual-use issues, where things that we intend for good purposes can very quickly be subverted for negative or nefarious purposes, and this is a big issue. So these are the events, actually, which will be catastrophic in nature. They will not be time-limited in the sense that they will just occur today. It'll be done. Some of these will unfold depending on whether there are transmitted agents from person to person after you first get infected or whether they stop like anthrax. Anthrax, fortunately, will not be transmitted from an ill person to another ill person. There could be environmental contamination, however, that could mean cases could occur potentially for days to weeks after the initial hit. That is an event, however, where we can count on the resources of our federal government as well as other state partners from around the country. And the sharing of those resources will be very, very helpful. We have stockpiles of antibiotics today that will be adequate to treat, in fact, the population the size of Minneapolis-St. Paul. So that event, while it's important, and I know we'll talk about that more, is one that I feel is as catastrophic as it might be, it is also manageable. The third event, which I would like to talk about, which I will spend most of my remarks on, is the one that basically keeps me up at night, and it should keep all of us in this room up at night. This is what I would call a catastrophic event of the third order, and that is namely pandemic influenza. Let me just make it very clear that pandemic influenzas have occurred dating back to Greek tragedies. Hippocrates described the event of pandemic influenza. We've had 10 of them in the last 300 years. We will have more. Pandemics like in earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis occur, and they will occur again. Our last pandemic, which fortunately was quite mild, was in 1968. If you think about it, just rough math, we typically have about 3 per 100 years. You can understand that we may be on the brink, time-wise, of another pandemic. Now, pandemic influenza occurs when a novel influenza strain emerges out of the avian population, and at that time, when it is in the avian population, is not capable of readily infecting humans, or if it does infect humans, it does not allow the virus to be transmitted from one person to another readily. When that all changes through either, one, a genetic mutation, or through a recombining with another influenza virus, then all bets are off. That's a new strain we haven't seen. We have no protection against it, and such as the pandemic unfolds. Typically, pandemics last anywhere from 6 to 18 months. They may come in number of waves, meaning that you may see, as we see with seasonal flu right now, which is obviously of great concern to us, but nothing to be what compared to a pandemic, may last for 6 to 12 weeks in one wave. It may disappear or at least die down as such for another 8 to 10, 12 weeks and come back again. Some pandemics have had one wave, some pandemics have had two waves, some pandemics have even had three waves lasting over 16 months. The number of cases and deaths with the pandemic in historic terms has varied dramatically. We often focus on 1918 because it was the severe one we can remember, where roughly at that time, anywhere from 50 to 100 million people worldwide died. The world population at the time was slightly under 2 billion people. Today we're at 6.5 billion people. And people often say, well, that was the worst-case scenario. Those of us who study this say, no, that wasn't the worst-case scenario. In 1580, a pandemic swept across the face of the earth, literally at a time when transportation was primarily on horseback, on foot, by cart, or by sailing ship. And when it swept through Europe, which it did in 6 weeks, 9,000 of the 81,000 residents of Rome died in 1 week. Some Spanish cities were entirely, totally depopulated. So that, in fact, bad pandemics have occurred in the past, mild pandemics. We don't know what the next one will be like. And as I will mention in a minute, I do believe our medical care system will be no better prepared to handle the next pandemic than it was in 1918. The issues we have to worry about today in terms of a pandemic was, well, how do we prepare ourselves and respond? One is vaccines. Today, our influenza vaccine system we have in this world is at best 1950s technology with one slight modification. We today have a problem as we speak with seasonal influenza, where the vaccine, which was formulated almost a year ago, obviously didn't meet the challenge of this year's circulating strains. Two of the three strains in the vaccine are providing little to no protection, and as such, we're seeing very serious seasonal flu problems around the country. That's because the way we make the vaccine in chicken eggs, using the virus that was circulating a year ago to make the vaccine, because it takes literally 8 to 12 months to make the vaccine, to make it so that we can provide it, means that we can never stay current. This vaccine, if it were in a routine childhood immunization or if it was part of any other routine immunization program, would be considered unacceptable. Unfortunately, we use this not because of safety issue or concerns, not because of safety issues. I want to tell you now it's a safe vaccine. I want to tell you that it's a good vaccine if it works, meaning we just by luck match up the strains from a year ago with this year. But it also is one that will not be readily available in time for a pandemic. Just as the strains that I talked about with seasonal flu this year have really changed not that much from a year ago, and we have little protection. With a pandemic strain, which could emerge literally overnight, we won't have a precursor necessarily that would be closely related to it that we could have already made vaccine with. To make vaccine for influenza today is much like a farmer planting corn in April. They can't wait until the end of July to see how the weather's been and whether they got enough soil moisture and then plant and hope it's done in October. You've got to put it in April. Today takes us literally that time period to make the vaccine. Well, pandemics will potentially come and go by that time. And so I would suggest to you right now that's a problem. Second of all, on a worldwide basis today, with all the capacity we have for licensed vaccines, using the current formulation, we can only make about 350 to 400 million doses of vaccine a year for the world. So that is far short of the 6.5 billion. There is no additional infrastructure. We're working to improve upon that. But again, it largely falls to the private sector to be responsible for that. And it's very possible, based on the most recent numbers I saw as late as earlier this week, even with this recent uptick in flu activity and increased immunization, we may end up throwing away more than 20 million doses of vaccine this year that will go unused because of the fact people just didn't get vaccinated. So I want to dispel any myth right now that vaccine is going to play a critical role in the early days of the pandemic and potentially may play a limited role throughout the duration. Same thing is true with antiviral drugs. Depending on the strain of the flu vaccine, we do not know which drugs might work. The current seasonal flu virus infection is very, very well treated with a drug known as Tamiflu or Relenza. The problem we have is that if it could be another strain like H5N1, the current one that we see primarily causing avian influenza in Asia, were to be the case, there is some concerns about how effective it would be. In addition, in the past month and a half, we've documented increasing drug resistance against Tamiflu in at least one of the strains of flu. We don't know if a pandemic will have the same. But finally, the last point to make is we have very little stockpiled Tamiflu for the world anyway. So even if we were to have a pandemic, it would be difficult to look at that. But one of the reasons that I look at this issue of pandemic influenza, let me just give you some sense of size. If today we were to have another 1918-like pandemic, and that would not be classified as the most severe, based on today's populations, that would amount to roughly 180 to 360 million deaths in a 12-month period. To give you some relative sense of what that means, HIV/AIDS which has clearly been a very serious public health problem around the world, in the past 30 years has killed 30 million people. So we're talking about 30 years to kill 30 million people. We're talking about a pandemic that could easily kill 180 to 360 million people in 1 year. This is not something to dismiss. In addition, the concern that many of us in public health have is that this will not be handled as a modern technology disease as we do so often with other infectious diseases where we have adequate vaccines or adequate infective agents. Why do I say this? Because today, this next pandemic will be the very first pandemic we will have ever had that will have been overlaid on the global just-in-time economy. Today, almost everything that we count on, that we use in this world of critical nature, is global in nature and is just in time. If you don't understand that, let me paint for you a very vivid example of something, a time bomb we are sitting on as we speak. 2.5 weeks ago, the Food and Drug Administration ordered a recall of heparin in this country by one company, Baxter International, because of a contaminant causing serious reactions among those getting the heparin, including a growing number of deaths. It turns out that the key critical ingredient for this heparin actually came from China in a plant that was not inspected by either the Chinese or the U.S. Well, I tell you this because this particular manufacturer makes half the heparin used in the United States, and right now we have a major serious shortfall. Heparin is an absolute requirement, or drugs like it, for people receiving dialysis, some 360,000 Americans. And right now in this state, we are on a 5-day basis for heparin. We are that short. And we don't know what the next 5 days are going to bring us. Well, that was complicated dramatically 12 hours ago when the German government announced a total recall of their heparin because they're having a similar problem with a totally different manufacturer who supplies much of the rest of the world's heparin. They, too, had the same Chinese source for their key ingredients. And in the next 2 weeks, we are going to be holding our breath whether we will have enough heparin to be able to just do the necessary medical procedures such as dialysis that we need. We are putting people's lives in jeopardy during a relatively good financial period without stress or pressure because single sourcing one plant somewhere in the world supplying critical nature issues. I will come to this more in a moment, but let me just say that today 85% of all the pharmaceutical products we use in this country are made offshore or have key critical ingredients made offshore. Those supply chains are very thin and very vulnerable. The average hospital in the state of Minnesota today in central supply receives drugs twice a day. Some are now 3 times a day because of the fact of this global just-in-time supply chain. Drug shortages are routine now in periods of good times. When a pandemic occurs, international borders are challenged. Travel and trade will be greatly reduced. Most of us expect we will have a calamity on things like something as critical as pharmaceutical products. And that's... One may laugh if one thinks about that as, well, there won't be enough Viagra. But think about it if there's not enough insulin, if there's not enough heparin, if there's not enough anti-infectives, the kinds of things that we count on routinely. In addition to that, today the world is one big global economy, as I mentioned. At any one time, there are 50,000 high-volume freighters who are on the high seas moving goods between China and the United States and other ports, including our oil. Of those high-volume freighters, which at this time are literally what you'd call piggyback trailer cars, some 1,200 of them on any one ship, which are the kind that then get offloaded at a port, put on a train, or put on the back of a semi-truck and loaded, is what moves our goods. Today, a good leaving Shanghai is in Long Beach, California in 10 days. That's what we count on. We don't have warehouses anymore. Our warehouses are what happens as the goods are being shipped. That's important because, again, any international trade and travel that impacts that will dramatically impact what you and I count on every day. Of note, of those 50,000 high-volume freighters that are out there, there are 1 million Panamanians and Bangladeshians who run those. And when I say 1 million at any one time, there's only 12 to 14 people on the ship. They're highly, highly specialized individuals who basically run certain cranes, etc. As of this time, no country, no organization, no public health institution has taken responsibility for these 1 million Panamanians or Bangladeshians who are basically doing the high seas sailing. There is an example of where we have many issues falling through the cracks right now, yet the critical products we're going to need here in Minnesota will soon be in short supply. Other areas of impact that a pandemic is going to have is immediately on energy. Today, energy, primarily in Minnesota, which is based on the back of coal, is a just-in-time delivery product by many standards for delivery to coal or electrical generation plants. We fortunately in this state probably have at least 30 days of coal on hand in any of our plants, but then as recent as 2005, where a train derailment in Wyoming meant that only two tracks out of Wyoming that can now actually haul coal are tracks that were not available. We ran dangerously short of supplies. We're doing a great deal of work. My colleague, Mr. Nick Kelly, and I, Nick's in the audience here today, have been doing a great deal of work on this issue. And one of the greatest vulnerabilities we have today in this country during a pandemic is, in fact, the inability to generate electricity because of the inability to move coal and, in some cases, even natural gas. When electricity goes down, and in the electrical generation and grid industry, let me tell you, this is a serious concern. All bets are off the table. You can't pump water for city water supplies. You won't have the lights. You won't have all the things. We worry about blackouts of hours duration. If we lose generation capacity, we're talking about electricity without for days. And right now, if you don't think that that can happen in China, we've had major power outages because of the inability to move coal over the past 6 weeks. Some provinces as much as half the week without power. Half of South Africa has been without power for weeks. Argentina's had major outages. So this is a worldwide issue, and we today, if a pandemic could overlay on this, and the 15,000 miners of Wyoming, which, by the way, are on nobody's priority list right now for vaccine, should it become available, or anyone responsible for rail movement in this country, that you can understand is a key priority. We have had a lack of leadership clearly amongst our federal agencies in this area. Transportation, I would just expand to say, if you can't make electricity, you can't distill petroleum, you can't move it. If you look today at the stockpiles of petroleum around this country, they're woefully small. Even the overnight express services have only limited overnight stockpiles today with the idea that somebody will supply that to them when they need it. And we have to be very thoughtful of that. Healthcare, I mentioned earlier that healthcare will be a real challenge. Today our healthcare system is already basically exploding at the seams. Right now in our Twin Cities, metropolitan area for that matter, the state, our hospitals are full with flu patients as we just see seasonal flu. And we have gnawed our healthcare system down to the bone, and frankly, we're sucking calcium. There is no major surge capacity. We can handle events like the Interstate 35 bridge, but if that had been, in fact, 5, 10, or 15 times larger, the system would have imploded. And that's an important point to know with pandemic flu, which will last over weeks and months. One, it'll be supplies. Two, it'll be workers. Having been at the CDC at the time of the SARS situation, I was very involved with what went on in Toronto. I saw a situation whereby the fourth week of that outbreak in Toronto, 25% of healthy healthcare workers would not come to work because they were afraid of contracting SARS on their job. We've never faced a modern public health plague, in a sense, among our healthcare workers. We have no clue what they will do. Initial data from one healthcare system in Detroit indicated that up to one half of all nurses and 40% of physicians said they will not come to work during a pandemic if they did not have a protective vaccine. So this is going to be a challenge. Do not count on the healthcare system to provide us what, in fact, we would normally think of as a typical response. Our food supply is a just-in-time delivery food supply. For those of us that have been involved with foodborne disease, we know that all too well because by the time we find out something's going on, it's well passed through the system. It used to be it would take literally months from a high-quality ice cream leaving the chill freezer through warehousing into the consumer's home. Months. Today, that's done in days. Today, many of our grocery stores in this Twin Cities gets its milk shipment daily, if not twice a day, literally from the udder to the mouth is hours. The point of it is I could go through a laundry list of foods, and including a very rapidly growing part of those foods that come from China. As recently as an example, I held up a loaf of bread, one that I would buy in any food store here in the Twin Cities. An average loaf of bread today has ingredients that come from 16 different countries. An average Nutri-Grain bar that I would hold up from Kellogg has ingredients from an average of 14 countries. Any one of those supply chains were to go down, it would seriously jeopardize the ability to make that food item. And today, we live in a global just-in-time economy. Pandemic flu will bring those supply chains down. I have no doubt about it. Communications will be a serious issue just in terms of the Internet. We do a lot of work with our Internet providers. Today, if everyone is at home trying to stay out of the harm's way by social distancing, the system today is not there to handle it. We will literally threaten the very existence of the Internet connections. And we can go into more on that over time. But the point is that we have serious issues there. Even something as simple as corpse management. In 1968, during the last pandemic, the average time from a casket being made till it went into the ground in this country is about 6 months. Today, it's a little over 4.5 weeks. A growing number of the parts and caskets themselves are all coming from China. We'll run out of caskets overnight. Our crematorium space is a just-in-time delivery system relying on natural gas. If natural gas shuts down, for which if you can't pump it, it will. In fact, we don't have catastrophic corpse management kinds of plans. We've been working largely with the Funeral Manufacturers Association and Casket Manufacturers Group around the country, and they see this as a very serious and significant concern. So what do we do? Well, first of all, don't get caught by surprise. I have to tell you that it was of some amazement to me on the morning of 9/11. I had just been at the Pentagon on 9/10 the day before at a meeting on the likelihood of a terrorist attack, and no one had a clue at the meeting that day that it was going to happen. I got into my office at the University of Minnesota early that morning when events began to unfold, and in fact was watching it like all of you. I was actually on an emergency response call list that was supposed to be activated during such events, and communications in D.C. obviously imploded immediately. That didn't happen. But I watched it like everyone else in the room here watched it that day in the TV. And I had a very, very sinking feeling that there was something else bothering me besides the shock and horror of watching what had happened. And it wasn't until later in the morning when my son, who at that time was a student at the University of Madison, called me. And he said, "Dad, how the hell did you know?" And I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, "How did you know?" And finally he told me what he was talking about. 1 year to the day before, on 9/11 of 2000, I had published a book called Living Terrors, What America Needs to Notify the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe. In that book, I discussed why the World Trade Center towers would stay our number one target in this country and why the Al-Qaeda wanted to bring it down. And, you know, I just assumed everybody knew that. And, of course, I say that some tongue-in-cheek. But I realized at that point what was really the issue that I was feeling that I hadn't been able to put my arms around is I couldn't understand why everybody was so surprised in 9/11. As shocked and horrified as we should be, why are we surprised? I mean, we saw that coming in a number of areas. Well, I just want to be clear today, we should not be shocked and surprised when the next pandemic comes, even if it's a moderate one in nature, and the global just in supply chains start to collapse rather quickly. We can't change the global just-in-time economy. I know that. I understand that. But what we can't do then is count on the current all-hazards approach and standard incident command structure for what's going to happen here. It's going to be stressed to the max. Medical Reserves Corps, which I'm very proud that our office at the University of Minnesota is very involved with the Minnesota Medical Reserve Corps and the University of Minnesota specifically. We have provided incredible support to the victims of Katrina following the hurricane down there. But during a pandemic, every town, every county, every city, every state, every country is going to be in the soup about the same time. There won't be Medical Reserve Corps moving from one area to the other, because even if it's not hitting one area at the same time as another area, we'll be hunkering down just trying to make sure supplies are there. When Secretary Mike Leavitt said 2 years ago for pandemic preparedness, every community is going to be on their own, he meant that. And he meant that not because he was, as accused by some, trying to cover his south side from another Katrina event, but he was actually trying to explain that when this happens, everyone will be in the soup at the same time. There won't be mutual aid packs between states. There won't be federal resources coming in. That is very different than what we count on today relative to our time-limited, geography-limited events that we typically plan for and care about. In addition, for example, we have no one in this country today who is in charge of allocating or ethically deciding who's going to get the very limited supplies. So if we can only supply part of the necessary life-saving pharmaceutical drugs, who gets them? Where do they go? Does the person with the highest bid get them? No private industry, pharma specifically, has a plan in place on how to allocate those areas. We need that kind of leadership. We can't stockpile our way out of this one. Today, if I were to tell you how many masks, gowns, gloves, and respirators we need to get through a pandemic, there is no way that you can buy enough resources, or more specifically, there's no way we could buy enough. The primary manufacturers of respirators, which one of them happens to be right here in our community, has not basically surged capacity their ability to make these. Why? Because if no one's going to buy it, why build facilities that no one's going to want to buy till the crisis is here? Because, in fact, that doesn't make good business sense. Right now, all the people who are making masks, gowns, gloves, and respirators are pretty much operating 24/7 with the plants they have, and very only limited stockpiling occurring. So if we wanted to buy them today, if the Minnesota legislature decided we're going to suddenly appropriate, and the governor agrees, millions and millions of dollars by us, we couldn't buy them if we needed to right now. The point is we're going to have to plan for that now. How are we going to handle very short supplies in our communities? We need to rethink critical business preparedness. I happen to live in a neighborhood of a number of Best Buy employees, so I say this with chuckle because, I mean, I don't want to favor anything, but as a Minnesota-based company, I often said in electronics, if Best Buy doesn't have it, you don't need it. But the bottom line is that I don't really care if Best Buy sells anything during a pandemic. I think they'll be challenged. But I do care a lot whether critical products that we need to get through a pandemic will be available. But having said that, many of these companies, like the Best Buys of the world, have incredible expertises in supply chain management, in transportation movement, where if they can be part of the solution to helping us through the pandemic, that would be a tremendous asset to us. We have not engaged those parties like that. We've typically engaged them more about what are they going to do to keep their businesses running, how are they going to stay solvent. This is something we need to do. So we also need to think about this issue of vaccine distribution. I come from the public health world. Public health runs in my blood and will be there in my ashes. But the point of it is that today we have, at a federal level, said to local public health agencies, practice giving vaccines, without any understanding that in the early days of the pandemic there won't be any vaccine. So the point being is we're going to have to practice how we're going to handle all these other issues. And I guess I would just conclude here by saying, on an emergency management basis, this is such a different kettle of fish. We need a new model. As we have demonstrated in this state, the incident command model, the NIMS approach, has been a wonderfully, wonderfully positive advancement in our emergency response system. But when you're dealing with an event that's lasting months in nature, that is bringing down the global supply chain, that is, in a sense, not allowing resources to move from one affected district to another to help out, that is such a different model, and we have little to no preparedness as a nation for that issue. Let me just conclude by saying that I know this all may sound extremely bleak, and it probably should, because it is. But I would caution us on two levels. One is don't deny its future happening, because it's going to. And it's interesting because human nature says that when you feel that way, you do one of two things. And this was brought home to me quite well a little over a year ago. I did an hour-long segment on Oprah on this. And as we all know, Oprah is the spokesperson of the world. And what Oprah says, people hear. And the day that the program aired here in the United States, I almost brought down the University of Minnesota email system personally by myself, because I heard from many, 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 many people. And it was very interesting because the emails were divided into two different separate camps. One said, you're a chicken little. You know, you shouldn't work at the University of Minnesota. You're a disgrace, et cetera, et cetera. One even thought I shouldn't be alive. Ooh. Because I was scaring people so badly and how wrong that was. There was a whole other group of emails that came in and said, you know, you're just like everybody else. You're covering this thing up. You're not telling us how bad it's going to be. You're not telling us how we're all going to die. And very few were in the middle. It was either we're all going to die or you're chicken little, because those are the two safe places to go as humans. Because if it's chicken little, there's nothing you need to do about it. If you're all going to die, there's nothing you need to do about it. There's nothing you can do. And the bottom line is there is a lot that we can do to be better prepared for pandemic influenza that go beyond the traditional emergency response model. We need to do that. So let me just conclude by saying Sir Winston Churchill said it very well. It's no use saying we're doing our best. You've got to succeed in doing what is necessary. And today, as much as the resources have been limited to our local and state public health agencies, they have not had the ability to take on models, as I've talked about here. You're going to hear from some of what I believe is some of the best planning in the country in the speakers after me for what is basically potential public health catastrophes. But if I could leave any impression with you at all, is that this is not a matter of if. It's just when and where and how bad it will be. And I have been in this, unfortunately, uncomfortable spot before. And I don't say this to sound as if, oh, boy, I know so much. I remember very well in 1984 when Secretary Margaret Heckler at that time announced that we would have an AIDS vaccine in 2 years. And I was quoted in papers the next day saying, I doubted we'd have an AIDS vaccine in my lifetime. There were many people who wanted to dismiss me as a nut and basically suggest that, oh, woe is me. I sit here today before you and tell you I believe we will not see an effective AIDS vaccine in my lifetime, and that's 20-some years later. 2 years later, the Minneapolis Star Tribune ran a three-day front-page series on Mike Osterholm's terrible predictions about HIV/AIDS, that it was going to be largely a heterosexual disease around the world and millions of people would die. Today, to go back and read that, the only real problem with that article is the estimates were not severe enough as to the impact. I go through a litany of these where we've been there before, and if all the ones I've ever talked about, there's none I'm more certain about is going to happen than this one. Again, it doesn't even take a severe pandemic to basically bring down the system I'm talking about. And so, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I hope, if nothing else, this group at least pays specific attention to pandemic flu, and if anything else, helps to sound the wake-up bell so that on the morning of another future 9/11 for pandemic flu, we're not all surprised. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. That's a sobering assessment of where we are and where we need to go and how in the world we get there. And I guess it is a whole world thing. Are there questions? I think I'll turn it back to you because you got here to start with. So.
Okay. I was thinking actually maybe we should hear from the Department of Health first, and then maybe we could do questions to them as a group.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it's Aggie Lighthizer and Renee Freundienst. Frauendienst. The local public health association. Please proceed with your testimony and start by giving your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the Minnesota Department of Health. And Renee and I are going to be doing a collaborative presentation today, but also I'll have her introduce herself.
My name is Renee Frauendienst, and I'm the Public Health Division Director for Stearns County Human Services. I am also the 2008 Chair for the Local Public Health Association, and it's in that capacity that I'm coming to you today. I will apologize ahead of time. I have a cold, and so I have all my little arsenal here. Hopefully I won't get a coughing spell, but if I do, I'll just step out, but I'll be back.
We're practicing social distancing.
Yes.
We wanted to talk a little bit about some various events that public health has been involved in, and we will also talk about scary pandemic influenza. But I want to do a little framework piece first. The federal role in health emergency preparedness and response is to provide a system, provide guidance, and particularly to provide funding. And that has been something that has really geared up in the last 5-6 years. We continue to evolve in health issues, and the federal role has been very supportive and important in that. We also have a series of state laws, regulations, and partners, particularly the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Public Safety, in helping develop the framework and the basic response system. And Renee mentioned the local public health and the state health department partnership is a collegial effort to work together. We have areas of specialty, areas where we work together. We're going to talk a little bit about the healthcare system role today. That is sort of a newer area in response. Prior to the funding and the support, the healthcare system was operating somewhat independently. They have now joined together and are part of our larger response, as well as tribal governments. They are involved in preparedness and are part of the planning and are engaged at the local, regional, and state level. And as I said, scary pandemic influenza. I wanted to start with just a little bit of background about what are the kinds of events that public health is involved in. And this map highlights some of the areas, and we'll just talk briefly about each of the kinds of events. And Renee and I are going to sort of tag team a little bit on that. I'm going to start with Operation Northern Comfort at Camp Ripley, which was an event following the Katrina hurricane. The governor asked us to be ready to take in 5,000 evacuees. that was a sort of a sentinel event for public health, healthcare system to work together, the public-private system, state-local system, to really move from literally 0 to 60 in 3 days. And I have been quoted as saying that we could have done brain surgery in the parking lot. The response was so tremendous and so heartwarming to see from across the state and particularly from the healthcare partners. There was also a large role for local
Yeah, it actually, Operation Northern Comfort, I think, was our first opportunity to really test the partnership that we had been building between local public health and the healthcare system in responding to some kind of a disaster. And actually, the 3 days that Northern Comfort actually occurred was over a holiday weekend. So we received notification at the local public health departments to ask to look internally to see what types of resources we would be able to garner in a support of Operation Northern Comfort. And actually, within a 24-hour period, I think almost all local public health agencies in Minnesota had been able to mobilize equipment, staff, and have discussions with their county boards or their city councils to talk through what kind of resources were the counties or the cities able to move forward to support this type of a function. We also provided expertise in pulling together guidelines as we looked at how were we going to potentially care for those 5,000 individuals. And so the work that we had done together with emergency management, public health, hospitals, clinics, and even emergency medical services, or EMS, were brought together at Northern Comfort for the first time, I would say, as we had begun planning as a community.
The next event is a natural gas disruption that occurred in Buffalo, Minnesota, where there was expected to be a gas outage of 48 hours, and you heard Dr. Osterholm talk about reliant we are on that. This was at a time when the temperature was down into the 20s. There were 5,500 facilities, nursing homes, and households that were affected. There was work done to get ready for meals and sheltering of the people affected, particularly the vulnerable population. But one of the things that did happen was as the gas company got ready to hook people back up, the local public health agency had done work to identify where are the vulnerable populations, and they had a list of people that needed to be hooked up first. So some of the work that had been done came into play in this event.
That plan that Aggie just talked about as far as prioritizing who needs to be reconnected first was a regional plan that had been adopted and put together by the local public health agencies in the region along with emergency management. So again, that partnership at the local level really set the stage for responding to this particular emergency.
Moving into last year, which seemed to be a year of a large number of events, the Browns Valley flood in March with evacuation, concerns about safe food and water, access to tetanus shots, what's appropriate cleanup information, when can you go back into your house, what about mold, questions and issues about safety of volunteers. One of the things that we really have focused on this last year is behavioral health support for the responders and for the victims of the flood. And that's going to come through in a variety of issues that we're seeing, is helping people manage the stress. At the health department, we're really good at developing 12-page fact sheets. In the midst of a flood, you can't read 12-page fact sheets. Who'd have thought? But one of the things that was critical and was coordinated at the local level was one-to-one support and advice and information to these victims once they were rescued from their situation, helping them recover and return to their normal lives or what's going to be their new life.
Just a couple things to highlight here. Actually, if you look at disasters in general and the role of public health in responding, there are two types of responses that we have. One is in a supportive role, and it's typically in those natural disasters like a flood or a tornado where public health's role is not necessarily the lead, but in a supportive role. In the disaster described by Dr. Osterholm, public health would be in the lead in that situation. In the floods, public health provides a supportive role. But there are also sort of three levels of response. You have that immediate response that occurs, and then you have sort of the short-term response that happens as you're trying to deal with the issues that are coming forward and help to get the community back into its pre-disaster state. But there is this long-term response that actually goes well beyond when everyone that has responded very appropriately goes home. Public health is still there. So we're there when it happens. We're there when we're trying to work the community back to its normal state. And we're there afterwards trying to help with some of the situations. For example, if you have some residual safe water issues beyond the flood, public health is there still working with the community to try to help change that and get the community back to its pre-disaster situation.
This hepatitis outbreak in Slayton from people who attended particular restaurants resulted in a number of cases, 7 cases, with 2 people hospitalized. Over a rainy weekend, 2,300 people received immunoglobulin who had been exposed to the disease investigation. There was a lot of issues around what's an appropriate cleanup for the restaurant, the interviews of the workers, helping coordinate with what care the health clinics are giving versus what the public clinic is going to do, and a lot of questions from the public. We had a hotline open and a lot of questions that came in from providers and from people who had been at the restaurant or concerned about their exposure.
I would consider this what I'd call a true public health emergency, where really public health was taking the lead. And sometimes we are caught unaware, and I'll just share with you a situation that happened in our community. I mean, if you look at the map, Slayton's pretty far from St. Cloud, and we weren't anticipating any real fallout as a result of this. But what we found is that, in fact, we have 3 large universities or colleges in our area, and a number of those students actually went home that weekend, actually, that all this had happened, and had eaten at that restaurant, and now were coming to us as a local public health agency asking what resources were available in our community for them to be treated. So while we thought we were many miles away and not necessarily needing to deal with this particular situation, because we have such a mobile population, and because we in our situation had a large group of individuals from that area that were affected by it, it really required us to mobilize our resources in our community and work closely with our providers to assure that there were the needed resources for those individuals that were affected by this situation.
Sam Lake Fire in May of 07, remember, there were a variety of people evacuated from their homes. People were in shelters, making sure that the safe food and water for people in shelters. Air quality concerns, people with respiratory diseases, what's their safety precautions. And again, behavioral health support and questions and issues about reentry. When is it safe to go back in and what kind of cleanup do you need to do?
And again, this is, I think, a good example of the supportive role that local public health does in communities when they're responding to these types of disasters. Again, it's mostly supportive, and we're really focusing in on assuring that those community health resources are well coordinated in our community as they either prepare to respond or respond to those situations.
The bridge collapse in August highlighted some new areas of health response. The hospital system kicked into high gear. A lot of people came and were offering help. They had been through training. They knew their roles. We had systems that alert responders to make sure people had the right information. There were plans in place for patient transport and care. Communication issues, while there were challenges because of the phone systems going down, there were some redundant systems in place so that we had some communication capacity. Again, with the Family Assistance Center and both responders and families affected, a lot of questions and issues about behavioral health support. And I don't mean to shortchange in any way environmental health issues, being able to understand quickly what might be some of the impacts of health issues has become something that we understand that we have some capacity, but not an unlimited capacity in.
And again, I would say that this highlights, I think, one of those things where the incident occurs, we responded well, but there still are some long-term effects that local public health and the state health department are really looking at, specifically around environmental health issues, behavioral health issues, as people have gone through a trauma and or individuals who in the community who have responded or been part of this particular incident.
Floods in southeast Minnesota, again, a large issue around safe food and drinking water. The wells that were flooded being, we still have wells that are contaminated. We are continuing to work with those families. Behavioral health support, we learned that because of the type of environment that it was, that behavioral health workers were wearing yellow vests, and the yellow jackets and bees had lost their homes as well, and somehow they seemed to be somewhat attracted to the yellow vests. We also had a number of people with bee sting reactions and needing to have rapid health care. The Mayo Clinic was particularly involved in that. Public information, access to health care, a health clinic was wiped out. We did have electronic health records, so people were able to move to another clinic and have their health care provided without information. Again, a lot of questions and issues around what's good cleanup, and we see that over and over again. People want to move back in before the cleanup has been completed. You're going to run into other kinds of problems, public information and hotline issues again.
And again, I think there's a lot of what happened at Northern Comfort you saw here as well. It was this mobilization across the state of looking at what kind of resources and staff and equipment and supplies, et cetera, would be available from other agencies around the state that would be able to help in the response. And again, there's still some issues that public health is working with those communities on, particularly around safe drinking water.
Pipeline explosion is the kind of event that would not have been on health radar in the past. But because of our increased connection to the healthcare system, we now are much more involved. We had ready alerts from the system, our electronic system. The hospitals were geared up to care for the injured. There were turned out not to be the need for that. There were a lot of concerns, though, that if there had been burned individuals who had survived, that with the high winds, they were not going to be able to evacuate with helicopters. Responders continue to have some issues around behavioral health and stress management, and again, public information, how big was the area, how much was affected.
And I think just in anticipation of these types of things in our communities as they come in, we in public health are now looking at who do we need to make sure is trained in able and being able to respond to these types of potential hazards in our community. So looking at training first responders and fire and rescue and working with these pipeline agencies that are working on these facilities that are coming through our communities.
Cottonwood School bus crash is something that we are still providing support for and working with other responders, particularly around training and support for students and community leaders and school. Again, our rapid reporting system alerted responders to that so that behavioral health providers were put on alert the night of the crash.
And again, local public health, we're really working with the local health care systems to assure that they had what they needed. And again, working with emergency medical services, again, assuring that there's coordination at the local level.
For whatever reason, South Central Minnesota didn't have a big disaster for us to put on the chart. However, they are doing a two-week exercise in June called SNAFLU, where they're going to be practicing some of their response activities. What we've learned is that healthcare providers without information are particularly scared. If they have some information, their response is going to be in better shape, and I think that's one of the messages and lessons we've learned. They're going to be working on issues of medical surge. How do we communicate? how do you manage scarce resources? That is one of the challenges, again, that Dr. Osterholm brought up. If you don't have enough, who gets it, or how can you stretch it? Getting medications to healthcare workers who may be at risk. Decision-making process, who decides? When do they decide? How do they decide? Particular issues around partner coordination.
These types of exercises, which are really important in working through planning processes that you've developed, really help us assess where the gaps may be and the services that we're anticipating that we'd be providing. I think the other thing that these exercises help, along with the disasters, is really help the skill building of our staff, and it also helps us get a sense for reality. What will it be like, or what could it potentially be like when we do get into these situations?
Seasonal influenza, which we are dealing with right now, involves some of the challenges that we are working on when we work on emergencies. I think one of the things that is really a benefit in public health is that being prepared for these day-to-day events helps us with emergencies. We're getting to know our partners better. We're getting to understand how to move materials quickly, and we're understanding how to make decisions and setting priorities.
The seasonal flu is almost like a three-letter a dirty word in our offices now, because every year for the past 6 years there has been some type of a glitch in how this has unfolded in our communities. And yet I think each year we learn more and more about how would we be responding to situations that come up in a very short time period that actually take a lot of resources in our community. Just for example, when we had the recent death of the 12-year-old, the first thing our community did is really looked at what is our vaccine supply, what do we have available so that if our community members really want to be able to be vaccinated, what is available, where is that, and where could we refer those individuals. We also looked at our partners at the Minnesota Department of Health to give us information on talking points of what is it that we want to tell our community in response to this type of situation. And then, again, working with our community providers, our clinics, as to how do we respond to a community request or a community need on a very short time basis.
One of the questions that we were asked to think about is what are the health risks? And so we have a very scientific slide here. Pretty likely, chemical. We have those actually now. Mercury exposures, spills, train derailments with chemical events. Biological, we've been talking about some of that this morning, some of the disease outbreaks. Natural, the floods, the tornadoes, ice storms, explosions, again with the potential exposure to hazardous chemicals, violence, the school shootings or other kinds of violent events, and potentially terrorism. Less likely, again, very scientific, radiological exposures, don't know. There's a lot of chatter out there right now about radiological dirty bomb events. We are doing some increased training about that. How likely is it? Don't know. Nuclear exposures, nuclear plant exposures, we have a very sophisticated planning process for that. How likely is it? Again, it's a good question. And again, terrorism, how likely is that? So that's the end of our scientific description today. What I do want to highlight, though, are some of the things that have happened because of the work that we've been doing. When we started down this healthcare and public health preparedness road, in 2001, we had some ability to call people on their office phone. If they were sitting at their office, we would be able to reach them. That was it. Not every public health agency throughout the state had computers even. Today, we have 24/7 ability to reach our partners, to reach local public health, to reach hospitals. We had 140 different hospital emergency plans. We now have 8 regional compacts where hospitals have agreed to help each other. We had limited local public health department involvement. We now have, this last year, 480 different exercises that people were engaged in and almost 2,000 community trainings. It's a huge increase in the capacity at the local level. We had very limited funding and very limited focus on emergency response. This last year, there was $23 million in federal funds for health care and public health preparedness. We had very limited connection between health and other responders. Health is now part of the response system, and we've seen that in a variety of examples that we gave today. 1997, during the floods up in the Red River Valley area, it took 6 weeks for us to develop some sort of cobbled-together behavioral health response for the families and the people who were affected by the floods. In the 2000 flood in southeast Minnesota, it took us 6 days to deploy 140 different people who were involved in providing behavioral health support to people in that area. We had no health volunteer system of any sort whatsoever. Today we have 7,000 volunteers who are registered in the Minnesota Response Medical Reserve Corps. We wanted to highlight a few issues around pandemic influenza. I'm not going to go into great detail on this chart, but this is to identify some of the numbers and the scope that we are looking at. We have been asked to think about a third of the people in the state being sick. That's 1.5 million people, give or take. And the expectation is that potentially 10% or so would require some level of hospitalization. We do have about 16,000 licensed beds in Minnesota, so not everyone is going to be able to have a hospital bed. What does that mean? How do we expand and encourage home care? What about alternate care sites? What about flu clinics? How do we manage the people who have the needs with the limited resources that we have? Ventilators, we've talked about that a little bit. The estimates are that 7% of the people in the hospital or who need hospital care would require a ventilator. That's about 13,000. We have about 1,100. We have a physician scientific advisory team that's been looking at this issue and coming up with clinical criteria. There's also an ethical group that's looking from the community level of how to set priorities. Are there age recommendations? Are there type of work that you do? Is it geographic? What might be some of the criteria? We're also looking at how do we manage, and Dr. Ostrom identified some of the challenges, the number of deaths. Again, the estimate is about 33,000. When we think about the health response for pandemic preparedness, it's sort of these larger areas. Disease identification, we have capacity in the laboratory. We have connections with local laboratory systems. How do we rapidly identify? When do we know when we have pandemic influenza in our community, in our state? Then we would move to issues around disease containment. How do we separate the people who are sick or exposed? Now, I'm not talking necessarily about isolation and quarantine, the legal process that's been put in place, but how do we help who are sick get the care they need and not expose others? If you're being cared for by your family members, how do you prevent them from being sick? We've been working with the Department of Education, with local school leaders on school closings and the challenges of not having children in school for 6 to 8 to 12 weeks. Most people who have teenagers start to get a little anxious about that concept. How do we prohibit public gatherings? What kind of public gatherings does that include? Is it the movies? Is it funerals? Healthcare services and limited resource priorities. Talked about that a little bit already. How do you manage if we don't have enough N95 masks to go around? Who gets them? We are working on vaccine and antiviral use and distribution policies and procedures. One of the challenges for public health is while we are in the midst of this very large event and response, is we need to maintain capacity to rapidly deploy vaccine. But my guess is when the vaccine becomes available that we won't have 5.1 million doses on day one. We will get some. We don't know yet how much that sum is, but who gets that first batch? Who gets the second batch? How long will it take us to get it out there? That's one of the challenges we're working on now. In antivirals, we have some stockpile, but again, it will not be enough. Public information is one of our critical countermeasures. We've been asked to think about maintaining capacity for countermeasure distribution. Information is a countermeasure. And support to the rest of the critical infrastructure and the community. to show you one of the practices that we're working on. This is the example of an alternate care site in 2008, and this is an example in 1918. And they look amazingly alike. I said the biggest difference is they're facing different directions. The cots look amazingly similar, sort of fancy lawn chairs. Into the future for pandemic influenza, this is the third and last year of targeted federal funding that we're receiving. We have got received funding from the legislature for a stockpile of antivirals and some other supplies. We are awaiting some new federal guidance for our plan updates, and we'll be working on that over the summer. That's both health, but also other state agencies. Ongoing training and exercises, Renee talked about that, important that is. Continuing to expect that pandemic influenza is part of our work into the future. But it does support response to other kinds of events. We get to know our partners. We get to know the issues. Just-in-time training, our specialized laboratory, mass clinic preparation, and continued efforts and encouragement and support for everybody to wash their hands a lot. I'm going to talk a little bit about from the health, state health department perspective what's still needed. Then Renee's going to talk some more from local public health association. Continued efforts around surge capacity planning. We're not going to be able to manufacture new workers, but how do we use the ones we have? How do we support them in coming to work? How do we keep them safe? How do we rapidly communicate information to our populations? And you'll hear a little bit later about some special population. How do we make sure that our necessary services continue, training and exercises? How do we evaluate? How do we measure our performance? And I'm going to end with continuing our support for our volunteers. We do have a policy bill that is being authored by the chairs of this committee, Representative Winkler and Senator Higgins, that would extend liability and workers' comp protection to the members of our Medical Reserve Corps. Succeed this year. And Renee's going to talk about some issues.
Yeah, we actually did a survey just in January of 2008 with our local public health departments and asking them to give us some feedback as to where they were at in the planning process. And so some of what I'm going to share with you in the next slides will actually just give back to you some of the information that we had received from our members in local public health. One of the things we did ask them, though, was sort of what needs to be done yet? What is it that is not completed? The first one that is the one that keeps me awake, Dr. Osterholm, and that's really helping our public understand their roles, their responsibilities, and even their expectations. If we get sick now, we go to the hospital and we get a lot of care. But when this happens, if we get sick and we have to go to the picture that you saw there of a cot, I'm wondering how our communities are going to respond to what they expect as far as health care. So that's one of the areas I think we really need to focus on. We also need to really look at these ongoing planning processes that we need to continue. We need to assess what is happening in our community. We need to evaluate that, and then we need to test those plans once we've developed those. We need to really look at the emergency preparedness principles, and what is it, as Dr. Osterholm said, what is it that is going to work in which situation? Incident Command currently works in a lot of our disaster responses, but will that work when we look at pandemic influenza? We have developed many, many, many community partnerships. We have worked with emergency management. We've worked with the hospitals, the clinics, the schools, the nursing homes, the home care agencies. We've also worked with our faith community. As we look at, as a community, how are we going to be responding to these types of situations in our communities? And that's going to take time, work, to actually maintain those partnerships. If we have situations where locally we won't be able to handle all of the needs in our community, what is it that we can do regionally to work better together? We will always have ongoing training. As plans change, as people change, we will need to train those individuals. There are still some equipment needs that we have in our community, not only supplies, but equipments that we actually need. And then again, looking just totally at communication systems and how will we be functioning in the various types of disasters that we will be faced with. The next slide actually looks at what is it that, when we asked our health departments, what is it that they feel they still need? And of the responses, we actually got 60 of 91 of our health departments responding, which is about 66%. And it was a really nice blend of both rural, suburban, and urban. But basically what they were telling us is that, first and foremost, is that there has to be some stable funding. And I'll go through some slides here that you'll see. Right now, the federal funding that we're receiving is getting less and less, and yet we still have many needs that are unmet, and things that will continue over time. The second was, again, the ability to train our staff, and that, again, requires time and money in order for us to be able to do that. The equipment, as I mentioned before, and then, again, this whole issue on investing in the public's education on what is their responsibility in preparing for any kind of disaster, and then what is it that they can expect in the future. The next two slides to share with you what types of funding we have been receiving. These are the federal dollars, and you'll see that the tan is what the State Health Department has received since 2002. The green is local public health, and then the orange is tribal government. So they have received a portion of these funds as well. But you can see that since 2005, local public health has received about one half of those dollars coming into the state. The next slide actually looks at just dollars that have gone to local public health. The green is showing the base amount that we receive in order for us to do the planning. In 2005, there were additional dollars that were provided to us for pandemic flu. And while it looks like it's increased the funding, along with those dollars came a whole set of grant duties that we were required to do that were somewhat separate from the planning that we were already due. I think probably the most important thing, though, is that these dollars are continuing to decrease. This year, I think, as Aggie had said, the pandemic dollars will be going away, and so we'll be left with only those federal dollars, which are decreasing over time. The other item that we did do in our survey to our staff is that we asked them, what other dollars are you using to support planning at the local level? And basically what we found is over the past 5 years, there are local tax levy dollars that actually have been put into this as well in both the planning and the response area, and you see that on the chart up here. And then also local public health agencies have gone to other sources, such as through grant dollars, federal grant dollars, state grant dollars, and then local grant dollars to help supplement the planning process over the past period of time.
Mr. Chair, that ends our presentation. We would.
Thank you. Questions from committee members, and I think we may, Dr. Osterholm, you can stay in your seat there, and we'll just try to have a discussion that includes you as well. Questions? Mr. Andreasen.
First of all, thank you to all three panelists for what I found to be really interesting and informative presentation. I do have a question, and it focuses on the state level, and it focuses on this aspect of training or simulation. You talked about the snafu exercise that's being done as part of a regional exercise in the state of Minnesota. Are we doing the kind of statewide planning to simulate or to exercise as a crisis management tool preparation for the kind of third-order catastrophic event that you described, Mike? Are we focused more on the kind of sub-state or even federal aspect of the problem?
Hey, you got a
slide, Heiser?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Andreasen, I would say that we are building toward that. The exercises to date have been more local, some regional. The Northeast area, for instance, did an exercise that involved 10,000 people who received bags of candy-coated candy. But we I would say, have not done the full-scale kind of exercise, a large event. We are doing a statewide policy exercise with everyone in the state summer, but I would say that we are building toward that and trying to take steps toward it, but we have not fully implemented that.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that something like that would be incredibly useful because for an event, the third-order catastrophic event that Mike was describing, it strikes me that you're somewhere in the middle, potentially, depending on the scope and scale, between a federal response and kind of a small-scale local response. So I'm just curious as to why we haven't yet done something like that.
Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, your question goes right to the heart of the planning. I think you're right on target. It would be like trying to tell the people of New Orleans we're going to plan for a Katrina-like event by, first of all, shutting off all your water, not giving you any food, turning off everything, and then making sure that we just really mix it up even worse, and then trying to follow through on that. And so part of it is I don't think we can ever realistically do what you're saying, which is obviously important when we have to do it. I mean, I think for emergency planners, if I were to look to Rocco here and say, imagine if he had to keep that incident command center operating at the level it did immediately after the bridge for 35 days consecutively, you know, that takes on the whole new meaning of what it means. And that just is impossible. I think that, but I think what you're asking is a very fair question. At least, can you even begin to game it and say, okay, what would you look at if you had a certain attrition rates? What would you do in healthcare workers? You know, what if law enforcement doesn't show up after? You know, no one had planned for the fact that 35% of law enforcement workers wouldn't show up for the New Orleans Police Department after Hurricane Katrina. We should have thought of that, though. If their houses were impacted, if their loved ones were lost, you know, wouldn't you think that would happen? So I think we need to start making those kinds of tough assumptions and then going at it from that perspective. Something as simple and yet as absolutely complicated as the food supply. And I think that's where we get into it. If you can't get food, if you can't get drugs, depending on the time of the year, frankly, I, for one, worry more about losing electricity in the summer than I do in the winter because although we'll have heating issues, you can keep people warm. But you're in the southern parts of the United States, trying to keep people cool in the absence of electricity is virtually impossible. And so, I mean, you start getting into other comorbidity or collateral issues, and I think we need to definitely do that. But no one has done that yet nationally. I think Minnesota's done it as well as anybody, because to jump there means people have to think like you'd think. And I will close by just saying I often ask people in New Orleans, I say, how would you have planned differently if the conditions that finally did exist post-Katrina were known to you 2 weeks in advance? And it's amazing the very simple, practical things that they would have done, meaning they weren't going to have more water, they weren't going to have more food, they weren't going to have more drugs, they weren't going to have these things. They actually thought of a lot of things, but they hadn't let their mind go to that point of thinking, and that's what the heart of your question.
And let me just, if I can just follow up on that, to give you a personal real-life example, when I graduated from the University of Minnesota and went to Washington and took a job in the State Department, one of the first things I was assigned to was the Continuity of Government program. And this was in the late 1980s when there was still a Soviet Union and we actually still worried about a nuclear exchange with Soviet Russia. And we did crisis management simulations at the federal level that involved some pretty unthinkable events. The scenarios we had at that time involved thousands of nuclear weapons detonating in the United States and around the world. And we actually were able to separate ourselves from our daily responsibilities for a week or so and start thinking about what that world would look like and what the challenges were and learn some things that probably couldn't be learned in the absence of that kind of simulation or exercise. So I recognize there's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, but I'm just pressing this point that at the state level, it might be useful if we haven't yet done it to actually think about putting together a scenario for the kind of thing that you're talking about and actually exercising that capability in some way where we would learn some of these things. And then just secondly, Mike, to the extent that we're thinking about these issues, I noticed you put up a page of assumptions about what we assumed in the case of a catastrophic third-order event. As I was listening to Mike's presentation, it seems to me that he was outlining some things that would make those assumptions a lot worse. In other words, kind of force multipliers, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And I'm just wondering to what extent, Mike, it's your perception that we factored those things in to the kind of assumptions we're making at the state level about what something like a third-order catastrophic event would look like.
Dr.
Sharon,
Osterholm.
You know, I think we're going to very likely have a dry run in a real way in the next 10 days, because if we really begin to see the world supply of heparin exhausted, we're going to have to figure out how the hell we're going to keep people on dialysis, let alone other life-saving issues. So I think that the thing you're raising is if you compound that by many other force multipliers, that's where it gets really hairy. If you don't have enough insulin, if you don't have enough antibiotics, I mean, it can go through a number of life-saving, life-sparing drugs that we use every day. You know, we're not even thinking about taking someone off of a chemotherapy regimen for cancer. That's down the road because they might get through for that for a few months, you know, et cetera. So I think it is, and it's all of those combined. You know, I have become, and in this, I've come to this of recent months in trying to work through this, is that I have realized, I believe right now, that the absolute foundation of public health in this country is electricity. If you don't have electricity, you can't keep cold chains, you can't make vaccines, you can't make food, you can't move food, you can't distill petroleum, you can't make transportation work, you can't pump water. I was just mentioning to Rocco, you know, something as simple as it would be important to pump water for people to drink in Minneapolis. You ever tried to put out a fire without water? I mean, all the second, third, and fourth order consequences are so substantial. So there are some things we have to do. Recently, the federal government put out a recommendation based on a group of what I call kind of community leaders, ethicists together, about who would get vaccine first. And in, I think, in a very compassionate way, they put women and children up front, along with some other critical infrastructure people who many of the ones I just talked about are not included. And we actually wrote in response to that and suggested that was not the way to go. And it's not because we're cold-hearted. If you want to save more women and children, you better support the basic infrastructures that keep them alive today. In 1900, the number one cause of death of children in this state was typhoid fever due to contaminated city water supplies in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And if we don't have water, I can tell you right now we're going to revert back quickly. Our cold chains for vaccines, all the other things we think about. So I think that your question is a very good one, and I think in Minnesota, if we could be a model or a pioneer, I would take these steps back. They're very uncomfortable. There are a lot of, you know, ambiguity around them, but I think if we don't do this, I mean, and I come back to, and I know, Rocco, you've been the source of many comments here, but if Rocco hadn't had the foresight years before for some of the equipment that was so critical the night of the Interstate 35 bridge collapse, where would we be today? And I think it's that kind of foresight now, because nobody, I mean, imagine if we'd had this discussion 6 months ago. Can you imagine the Interstate 35 bridge collapsing? Everybody say, well, come on, you know, I can see some county bridge collapsing out in, you know, Fillmore County, but I can't see the busiest bridge in the state collapsing. We need to think like that, because you know what? Those things happen, and with pandemic flu, it is going to happen. And I don't want to have people walk out of here having me say it's a severe pandemic that's going to happen. I don't know that, but the global supply chain will go down quickly, even with a moderate pandemic.
If I could, then, just a follow-up to Aggie and Renee, taking into account, Mike, your presentation of what you just said, is it your sense that in the context of the assumptions you're making for a pandemic, that you've thought of some of these force multipliers, the second or third order impacts that Mike is talking about, and how they're going to make your assumptions even worse, or I should say could make your assumptions even worse?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Andreessen, I would say that we have thought about it. I would say that we have not fully incorporated that. We're probably doing a walk, then run kind of timeline. And your comments are very well taken.
And then my second question would be, would it help if you made as it a priority the kind of state-level simulation that, as I understand it, we haven't yet really done, although we're working up to? Could that help you uncover some of this? I guess that's a question to both of you and to Mike.
If I could, Mr. Chair, if I could maybe answer a little bit to what Aggie said. At the local level, it depends upon the agency. But I do think that some of that is beginning to happen at the local level. I know in our county, public health and our emergency manager have met with several of our businesses, like our grocery stores, to talk with them about how do you get your food in, who is your hauler, Those types of things. Have you thought about what happens if you cannot get that food? And so I think some of that is beginning to happen at the local level. Has that been incorporated into a plan yet? No. I think we're still in the exploration process of what would that potentially look like, for example, in Stearns County, and how would that directly affect us? We've had some conversations with some of our banking facilities as well, saying if you're relying on the internet for your banking purposes, again, how would that potentially affect our community? We've sort of taken the perspective of there's three levels in planning. One is personal. You know, you have to take personal responsibility. Right. The second is you have continuity of operations as your business. So what is it that you're going to do to keep your business going? But the third is that you are part of the community, and what is it that you bring to the community or you won't bring to the right. community if a disaster happens?
But again, my question, and I understand that, is really, would it help you to do the kind of statewide simulation in terms of getting at some of those issues that I was talking about as a priority?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do believe that that would really be helpful. It would be helpful, I think, from the perspective as a county agency and as a city to look at what is it that we need to continue to move forward in planning. I also think it would help our businesses begin to see how this could potentially affect them.
Dr. Osterholm.
Mr. Chair, I think in following up with that, Steve, I just give you a little anecdote here that actually as this heparin situation unfolded, I contacted a number of senior nephrologists in the state, kidney doctors that deal with this issue, and one of the most senior ones said to me, how the hell can this be happening? I mean, he had never thought of this before, even though that was a critical part of what he did every day, that there could be a shortage of heparin, because he had no idea what the supply chain was. He just assumed every day it would be there, just like all of us. We assume that things will be there because they're just always there. And I think when I gave the example of the food supply and the complexity of these products, any manufacturer will tell you that if anything happens to global supply chains right now, they don't have second, third sourcing. We would see a dramatic reduction in the food that could be produced. When we've looked at something as simple as not just the food, but the packaging, today packaging is a just-in-time delivery. So you can get shelf-stable foods if you can get them, but it's the cans that they come in. That's just-in-time delivery. And so part of what we have to do is all of us have to take a step back and say, okay, what are the assumptions that we should be making here? And if those things aren't available, what can we do to get through? A second piece, though, is I think we've not had the federal leadership. And I say that as somebody who's worked clearly there, and I think we need to push and hold the feds to their feet on this issue in a big way, because much of this coordination can only occur at a federal level because it involves multinational companies. It involves the kind of things that Minnesotans in and of by themselves can't do. And the third thing I think that, again, we all need to be asking ourselves, have you heard this issue come up once during the election cycle and the debates, the questions? This isn't on anybody's radar screen. And yet I can't tell you, I can think of a more catastrophic event than this. We do have the potential to make a vaccine one day that I believe could be a universal vaccine against influenza. Unlike my comments on flu, I believe, or on HIV, I believe we could do this, that would actually be able to be made months, if years not in advance, would cover a multitude of different flu types, and we could make the capacity to vaccinate the world. We have spent, as a world combined, as much on research on that vaccine as we spend in 2.5 hours in Iraq. Now, you tell me what the issues around safety, planning, and future priorities are. So, I mean, I think we all need to wake up to this. And what I, again, worry is one day we're going to be in the middle of this one, and then we're all going to wake up to it. So I think as a state, the more we can do to highlight this, bring our business community on so that they do see what this means. Because everyone, as I mentioned earlier to my friends at Best Buy, every one of the things they bring come in those cargo holds that I told you about that aren't going to be moving.
Mr. Forte.
I'd just like to say that from an emergency management perspective, you almost have three different worlds. It's the first responders, it's emergency managers, and it's the health community. Yeah. And we've certainly been working together. But in reality, from my perspective, the health community is probably about where the emergency management was about 10 years ago. They're really just starting to look at the system and identify what system has to be built. Emergency management, really, an incident command system, is based on the fact that you can always go somewhere and get resources. You either go through the city, the county, the state, the federal government, but something's always coming to you. We're talking about a situation right now where the resources are depleted. One area emergency management's going to help with that, which is not the healthcare part of it, But we're looking at what happens to city government, our state government, as we lose resources being our workforce. Who do we have to train to keep the water systems up when 80% of those individuals are gone? We know we have to keep the water going. We know we have to keep the electrical grids up. So we're looking at how we do that as we deplete our workforces, but we are not dealing, quite frankly, with what the management system will be of the pharmaceuticals or whenever we do get it, how we prioritize. And that all has to be put together in a plan, quite frankly. And I'm not sure if we could actually do a statewide plan right now because we really haven't developed it. Yep. And so I think we're in those early stages where we have to continue these type of conversations, but we have to start moving on putting those plans together.
Mr. Andreasen.
But, Rocco, would it help you if there was, let's just say in 6 months, we could have a statewide crisis management simulation of the kind of third-order catastrophic event that Mike was describing? Wouldn't that help you put together exactly that kind of plan if we could do something like that?
It would help us do a gap analysis of where we need to go, but we really need to put those plans together.
Okay. Dr. Oster.
I think, Steve, you really hit on a good point, Mr. Chair, is the fact that it's all about assumptions.
Right.
And imagine if you had to assume for planning the Twin Cities that the bridge went down, the mall blew up, and the IDS tower collapsed all at the same night. Then you say, well, that wouldn't happen. And obviously there are some that are so far out that they would never make sense. But I think on the other hand, the kinds of things I talked about are real-life events that are happening right now. If you want to look at the complexity of the global just-in-time supply chain, you can look at that. The issue of how food is moving or any of these things, communication issues, the Internet. The Internet has had minimal investment in the big pipes since the implosion of 2001. We've been tracing that very carefully. The Internet right now is really falling behind on what had happened. They overbuilt it in the late 1900s to early 2000. Investments weren't coming then because of course, the collapse, and now we're in this thing. If we tried to move a lot of things, I hear people all the time say, well, we'll just communicate by Internet. What happens if that doesn't happen? The last point I'd just like to make, which I think Rocco really was right on target, is we don't have any depth to our planning in the sense of redundancy for personnel. I mean, who's going to lead our state? What if the governor dies? I mean, what if we don't have we've always made the assumption that when an event happens, there's some distant group that will come in and that there is some distant group that will be distant. They'll coordinate all this. In a pandemic, we're all in it. We're all, you know, we could lose, half the leadership of the state of Minnesota. What are we going to do? You know, if you're on the battlefield and a lieutenant gets killed, a sergeant steps up and becomes a lieutenant. We don't have plans at all for much of the leadership redundancy in 3-deep that we need. And that's critical. We don't have it in corporate America, and we don't have it in the public sector in most areas. That, too, is going to be very, very critical.
Further questions? I have a couple of, a direct follow-up, and it could go, I think, probably to Dr. Osterholm, but any of you, really, which is that there are a great number of resources that we have available in the state of Minnesota to begin looking at this just based on the exchange that we have in this room. And there's, of course, an issue. There's only so much that the Department of Health itself can be tasked with doing. Are there partnerships that could begin to accelerate some of the planning and some of the preparedness that we could bring to bear? I assume that there's a great deal of this that happens already, but is there a way that the state could help direct a more deliberate effort in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, let me just make one point, and as a neutral party to all of this now, the federal resources for the kind of planning we need to talk about are drying up, and they're drying up mightily. You heard that. If you're going to expect any of the state agencies to embark upon what I think would be a major effort, and I think Steve's done a great job of laying out a framework for how you might look at that, those are going to take resources. And you can't rob Peter to pay Paul because these agencies right now are, they're living from hand, basically robbing Peter to pay Paul now for a lot of these things. This is going to be a lot of work, but it's work that will never be wasted. It will, unlike a lot of things, if you asked me if a terrorist event was going to happen, I couldn't tell you that. Preparedness for that might one day be considered by many to have been wasted if it didn't happen in 20 years. This is going to happen. This would be like being in California and talking about earthquakes and say we don't need to plan for earthquakes anymore. We've not had one in 20 years. We are going to have this happen. So I hope that the state of Minnesota sees the wisdom in a short-term investment in what I know will be a long-term insurance policy by doing better preparedness, but they can't do it by just wishing it to happen, and they can't do it by putting it on the backs of state and local agencies that right now are losing all their other funding to do it. But I think you're right. We could do it. We could become a much better model here. And I think that that would be a very important role that this group could pass out to the rest of the state, I think, and clearly the legislature about what could be done.
And I guess as a follow-up, and Ms. Lighthizer can weigh in on this as well, but, you know, there's one thing the state of Minnesota or the legislature can do, and that's write checks. But identifying policy priorities and helping to direct resources to work together is another thing that we can do, but we don't have a great deal of expertise, certainly in the legislature, about how to do that. And I guess one outcome could be if CIDRAP in combination with the Department of Health or who it is, but could at least give a set of policy recommendations for us as to direct how we could accelerate this and identify if we were to write a larger check for this, what would we get for it and how could we move it more quickly forward?
If, Mr. Chairman, let me just say some of the issues about writing the check is not about building things. It's having the people that can dedicate it. For example, our group here, Mr. Kelly and I, have – you can't tell you how many energy people have said, you know, nobody's ever asked us that question before. We've never looked at that issue. And, you know, what are we doing this? I mean, we're just a little university center somewhere. No one has a plan to secure the mines in Wyoming. No one has a plan to secure the railroads from Wyoming to Minnesota such that you can have whatever plan you want at Xcel to basically run that plant. But if you don't have coal and you can't get natural gas, you can't run the plant. Just the ability to plan for that, that's even interstate. But what are our interests and considerations? I could go through a laundry list of those kinds of things right now that it just takes human power. It doesn't take a building. It doesn't take another machine, but it takes considerations. Right now for planning for drugs, I think it's going to be horrible because I think that the personal impact of not being able to get a life-saving drug during this time period will be real. If we have a thoughtful and a fair way to deal with that, that's going to help everyone. What we don't want to do is try to invent that right as we're suddenly confronted with it. That would be something, again, that the state could very much support to be done here. And so I think there's a lot that could be done by just supporting this power that would develop policies that are the kind you're talking about.
Ms. Lighthizer, do you have
Mr. Chair, I would add to what Dr. Osterholm is saying. I think that, and I appreciate Mr. Forte's comments about we're still developing some of our capacity and understanding really how health works, how it connects, how it be is part of it. In Minnesota, the Chapter 12 and Emergency Management Act really outlines the structure of how Minnesota responds. There's a lot of partnerships that have developed and evolved. There's been a lot of work and thinking around mutual aid agreements. And so there may be some policy recommendations and issues that could be more formalized and could be more structured. Right now, with the funding level that we have available to us, about 40 of the local health departments get about $18,000 a year for emergency preparedness. So about a quarter of a person to do planning and training and exercise and community connections and participate in response. So it's a bit of a challenge. I don't know what those policy recommendations or partnerships are right today, but I do think if we work with our usual response partners, the National Guard, our other state agencies, local health departments, healthcare systems, we could develop some of those partnerships. One is how do we rapidly and readily deploy volunteers, and that is one of the policy issues we have brought forward.
And just an observation, and I invite response. If I roll up the big issues that I have observed through this set of meetings, one big issue that we have is incident response in Greater Minnesota and the lack of capacity there and lack of planning and training, et cetera. It seems to me that this is just our discussion today has highlighted our broad-scale pandemic kind of response preparedness. There's two areas where the state really is not doing the most it could be doing. and that greater funding could help. I guess the issue is always making sure that when we're ready to put our foot on the gas for funding, that we're really going to be moving forward and that we're ready for that. And so it sounds like we have some more work to do in the public health arena to do that. And I guess I'd also be curious to know if there are other comments about public health incident response, such as the list that they presented on, and if if there are other gaps there, and if it's urban versus rural, that kind of thing.
I have to make a comment, and I have to go. This has been phenomenal, and I look at the operation of our world with a three-legged stool of the economic realm and the cultural realm, which includes everything that we are living and breathing and including our health and well-being, and then the government realm. And I believe we have tilted way too far toward the economic and assume that that will take care of everything and that it will solve the problems just by virtue of being in existence. And the government realm has taken a much more backseat than it really should be, because that's the realm that provides the oversight. For this group right here, I was delighted to be on it because it said disasters, not the terrorism part, because of this. And here we sit with, we're supposed to make recommendations, and here we sit with an expert that has great foresight. And if I think a key recommendation of this group is to not just say this is important, but to actually come out with some sort of follow-up to make this happen. To make this happen, we have to do this.
Mr. Andreessen.
And I would just say, to be specific and kind of summarizing my own comments, I mean, it seems to me that one specific thing we should consider is that the state actually do a crisis management exercise in this area of a third-order catastrophic pandemic at the state level. Now, that does require time. It requires resources. It requires a plan. But in my own experience, it's invaluable to get people who are going to have to deal with this to do that kind of exercise, even if it's for 24 or 48 hours, which is an unrealistically short period of time, because you can actually uncover then some of your assumptions and factor in some of the things that Mike is talking about and see how people react, and that will get them thinking about things they haven't been thinking about in terms of how they're going to respond when, as you say, Mike, inevitably something like this happens. So, again, I think that's something for us to think about, is whether we can actually suggest to the state of Minnesota that whoever is the responsible entity, and that's actually another question I had, is who might we suggest that to, actually have that kind of a crisis management exercise or simulation involving some of the people in this room where we would challenge our assumptions and uncover some of the vulnerabilities. Because my guess is the assumptions chart that you put up just listening to Mike is much worse than what you showed. And you had 6 or 7 boxes, and there's probably 15 or 20 boxes that should be on that kind of a chart.
Mr. Chairman, I could agree more. Again, I just come back to the fact that one is going to take leadership. And what happens is, if you don't have the business community, you don't have government leaders involved, you don't have the realistic issues, because once they're confronted with it, they see it.
And to be clear, they should be a part of the exercise.
I think the second thing is, a resource standpoint, you can't do this by, as Aggie just very appropriately pointed out, by giving a county, $18,000 a year and saying, okay, plan for this. It takes more buy-in. The other thing is, I think you have to be creative and imaginative. And when I say that is, I mean you have to have logical creativity, meaning you can't, it's not as if you're going to just, the Martians are coming. But all the things we're talking about, the global supply chain issues, are very readily documentable. They're ones that we're seeing happen every day in our lives. It's just when you get the false force multiplier, again, all the events. Just to give you a sense, during SARS, 80% of all the flights in and out of Hong Kong for 12 weeks were shut down. You can see SARS in Hong Kong would have been no worse than a moderate pandemic today anywhere else in the world. You can see how global trade and travel can be so impacted so quickly. So these are reasonable assumptions you can make. You don't have to really go. So I think you're right on target, and I think that would be a great contribution out of this group. The last thing that I'd make is, I think I want to just emphasize, I think we need much more of the kind of learning or experience sharing from people like Rocco, because I think he's absolutely right about emergency management is much farther along. We need to now take that back to more of the whole medical business world and take it out of just the realm of this one single event. But what they've learned over the past 10 years has been invaluable, and that would really be helpful to bring that more into this world.
Mr. Forte.
Just a last note. I appreciate the comments. I always tell everybody the reason we were successful at the bridge collapse is because of relationships, planning, and training, and the proper equipment. We don't have that in this area. And I think what Steve is saying, let's put a plan together and exercise that. We have the relationships, so I think it is time to move forward.
And the kind of next stage, and we still have another 30 minutes of presentation that we're going to get to, but this seems like a good time to discuss this, is that Senator Higgins has a couple of staff who are trying to put together all of the materials that we have been presented to us and the testimony that we've had, and tried to organize a document that it would basically be a summary of findings or information that we've been presented, and I think try to do that through the remainder of the legislative session. There are some pieces of legislation that are moving as a result of this as well. But we are going to try to, I think, assemble a list of priorities or lessons learned or kind of the state of the state with regard to disaster and terror preparedness. And my hope is that we have kind of a high-level draft of some information to share in May, and that we can move through the summer and try to put together, fill some additional gaps of information that we don't yet have, I don't think, but try to put together kind of a report that we could present and could be lay the foundation for from further public policy discussion and funding, I hope.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, there's no reason not to continue doing whatever we can, right, of course.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, if I could just point out, the Local Public Health Association, as part of our survey that we did ask our agencies to give us some information on what is, as I said before, what is missing and what would be missing if we lost our funding from the local public health perspective. And you do have that as a handout, and I just wanted to just highlight that for you. And there is some information on there is what would happen if local public health wasn't there available to assist in response.
Thank you. And, you know, to be clear, of course, this will be part of the many legislative priorities that we will be addressing in the next budget session in 2009. And I think building a case as best we can prior to that for what our priorities should be and where we can put funding to make the biggest difference in all of these areas will be an important part of what we can do. Dr.
Mr.
Osterholm.
Chair, one last comment. I hope that my comments have not come across as if we're talking about a big capital investment. I think what we're talking about is a leadership investment and a coordination investment. And so the amount of resources we're talking about here is not large relative to what I think the impact could be. But you have to get through that first step first to just figure out. I mean, we're not talking about building plants to make drugs. We're talking about having a group in Minnesota that's well-honed and prepared. If they have to make very hard choices who's going to get what few drugs are coming in or how we're going to do that, they can do it. You know, even keeping the trains running doesn't mean we build new train tracks. It means that we have a plan in place to work with the private sector to make sure that there's coordination, there's prioritization, and there's even legal precedents for what we need to do during a pandemic. So I think a lot of these things shouldn't be, you know, because I know everybody wants money over here. I think what we're asking for as much is leadership and coordination.
And Dr. Osterholm, that's absolutely correct, but the two will go together, and so we need to make sure we're ready for the limited session time that
we
have. And thank you, Ms. Lighthizer and Ms. Frohn-Dienst. We will move on to the third part of the agenda, Joan Wilshire and Lillian McDonald.
Okay, so how many millions of dollars did you find today? Sorry.
Understand.
Make this a page. Fill in where you can.
That's right.
I just mapped it. Canadian.
Please proceed with your testimony and state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And today we also have with me Margot Indwick-Cross, one of my staff who is an accessibility specialist who also specializes in emergency preparedness for people with disabilities. This morning, we're here to talk to you about not only our agency and what the Minnesota State Council on Disability does, but we're going to share with you a little bit about what people with disabilities need in case of an emergency, how to plan for them, and as well as to talk a little bit about some legislative initiatives that need to happen in order to make all of this happen that we're going to be talking about. And it looks like we're trying to get the document here working. I guess I'll just continue. You've got some hard copies of it, I would imagine, right?
Yep.
Okay. We're moving on to the second slide here. In 1973, the Minnesota State Council on Disability was created. And the good news is we're celebrating our 35th anniversary of existence here as a state agency. So we're excited. And we exist primarily to advise the governor, state legislature, state agencies, and the public regarding disability issues. So we're thrilled to be celebrating that. Some of the issues that we work on, just to again give you a little background of who we are, we work on employment issues regarding ADA, transportation, voting elections, disability parking, a little bit of housing, some health care, and then, of course, emergency preparedness is probably our newest issue that we're now working on. We have a 21-member governor appointment council that governs our agency and staff of around 5.6 people and with $1 million biennium appropriation. Now, moving on to emergency preparedness. After 9/11, there was heightened concern and awareness about evacuation of people with disabilities. We've all known that President Bush had executed an order for individuals with disabilities and basically said that the order directs that the federal government is to work together with state, local, and tribal governments as well as private organizations to appropriately address the safety and security needs of people with disabilities. As we move forward, counties and cities throughout Minnesota started the emergency planning process for the communities. Potential threats were identified, plans were developed that addressed communicating in an emergency, mass evacuation, and, of course, shelter-in-place options. Members of the disability community expressed concern about lack of participating and involvement in the planning process for the development of emergency preparedness plans. And in short, what we want to be talking about here is that people with disabilities need to be a part of the plan, and they need not be always viewed as just the problem, but actually be looked at as part of the solution.
Hello, Mr. Chair, my name is Margo Imdick-Cross. I'm the accessibility specialist for the Minnesota State Council on Disability. As our handout indicates, research and anecdotal evidence indicates that planning, preparedness, response, and recovery efforts often overlook the needs and perspectives of people with disabilities. When we talk about people with disabilities, we're talking about a substantial portion of the population. We're simply not talking about a handful of people. We're talking about approximately 20% of the population has a disability as defined by law. Of that 20%, approximately 60% have mobility disabilities. So we are talking about a huge percent of the population that has specific issues that need to be addressed in the event of an emergency, and be that the planning, the response, the evacuation, whatever the appropriate response is. Emergency impact on people with disabilities covers a number of issues, including access to communication. If an individual is deaf or hard of hearing, if a person is blind or low vision, are they going to be able to receive the communication that's being put out by the county, by the municipality, by, if there's a crawl along the bottom of the television, if somebody low vision, is my grandmother going to be able to see that? If somebody's deaf or hard of hearing, what's going to happen if the sirens go off to notify people of an emergency? And so notification is a critical issue for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, and in many instances, blind and low vision. Access to transportation. Many individuals with disabilities have to rely heavily on lift-equipped vehicles. Many communities throughout Minnesota have a very limited supply of lift-equipped vehicles. Many have no lift-equipped vehicles. And so if you're an individual who because of a disability, needs to rely on this, what are you going to do in the event of an emergency? Accessible shelters. It's critically important from our perspective at the State Council on Disability that all shelters meet a minimal level of accessibility. And that's because you don't want to break up your natural support systems. I happen to rely heavily on my immediate family for many needs that I have as an individual with a disability. If you take me away from them and out of a setting that they would be in if we had to go to an emergency shelter, then someone else is going to have to assist me. And why overburden the system when the natural supports are already in place? So we're saying that whatever the evacuation is, whatever the evacuation plan is, if there are shelters involved in that, and in most instances there would be, that those shelters do meet a minimum level of accessibility. Personal care assistance for those individuals who don't have natural supports in place. Assistive technology, backup medical equipment, everything from wheelchairs to reachers to magnifying glasses. Is there a supply? Is there a resource? Is there a, you know, these are all ways that emergencies impact people with disabilities. Service and companion animals. We saw the heartbreak that happened in Katrina with the pets, but there's also service animals that actually assist and aid people with disabilities. Many of us are familiar with that through guide dogs and other service animals.
I was going to add a few things here. Regarding transportation, there are seven counties in the state of Minnesota that still do not have accessible transportation. So that is huge when you're looking at people with disabilities and how are you going to evacuate. And many of these smaller counties depend on their larger counties. And so if the larger counties are going to be busy with their own emergency, do we just forget about the smaller counties that have no emergency or no accessible transportation? And two quick stories regarding transportation, just to send this message home, how bad transportation is for people with disabilities or how big of an issue it is. Over the holidays, a person with a disability went to one of our local hospitals, sought medical care, received it, needed to get home, could not find transportation to get home over Christmas, spent 2 days in the emergency room because they could not get home. Another issue of transportation, somewhat on that same line, where an individual with disability ended up calling 911 and used the ambulance to get to the drugstore to get their prescription drug that they needed from their physician because they had no other means of getting there. So these are just two incidents of that I think we need to be aware of, that how the system just doesn't always work in our behalf. And also I think we need to be aware of access to prevention plans. We have some wonderful prevention plans out there developed for all of us, and we need to just make sure as we're developing these plans we think about all the different minority groups, whether it's access to language or just physical access, that we make sure we incorporate them in our prevention plans.
Thank you. Okay. To address these issues, our agency, MISCOD, is partnering with a number of other state agencies and others, including the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Division, the American Red Cross, and the City of Minneapolis. What have we accomplished to date? To date, the State Council on Disability has organized a statewide emergency preparedness conference that focused on disability issues. Our goal for that was to educate emergency planners on disability issues, bring together emergency planners with people with disabilities to initiate dialogue on emergency preparedness, to develop and conduct emergency preparedness presentations for emergency for individuals with disabilities on personal responsibility, and that's really quite critical. We have a huge population of people with disabilities. Many of us are under the assumption that if there is a disaster, somebody's going to magically appear at our door and take us away on a white horse with the ramp. That's not going to happen. And so we're out there meeting with people with disabilities saying, no, you know, the first line of defense is you. You've got to be prepared. And we're pretty successful in getting that message across. An example we have on the preparedness of people with disabilities has to do with the 9/11. And an individual with a disability who worked on the 69th floor of the World Trade Center was a man with a mobility impairment. And in 1993, when that building was bombed, it took him over 6 hours to evacuate out of that building. And he was concerned. He felt for sure that if there had been another, he had to be prepared. So he took it upon himself to work with his employer to get the evacuation equipment he needed, to train his fellow employees on how to evacuate him. And in 2001, when 9/11 occurred, It took him an hour and a half. He had reduced the time from 6 hours to an hour and a half, and it literally saved his life. So it's really important, I think, you know, for a number of perspectives, both when you're at home and when you're at work and in a volunteer setting. People with disabilities have to be cognizant of their surroundings. They have to be aware of the way out, and that's some of the stuff that we teach and train people on. We also do emergency preparedness for employers, because a lot of employers don't think it's really their responsibility. They just think if they call 911 that the first responders will take care of everything. And so we try to educate employers on this as well. And we've worked with emergency managers and first responders on disability awareness training. We have developed informational brochures and toolkits for people with disabilities and employers. And we've started to establish regional disability teams to advise regional and county emergency planners. It's critically important, again, in each Homeland Security region, that there be a group of experts who can work with the individual counties in the development of their plans. As Joan indicated earlier, that was the biggest complaint we had, is that these plans are being developed. People with disabilities are not at the table. You know, our input is not being sought. We're not part of the discussion. And we're such an incredibly, incredibly large portion of the population, and we have such unique needs. So it's really, I think, advisable that each of the Homeland Security regions have these groups of disability experts, and we're working to make that happen. What's needed for people with disabilities? I'll take this one and then hand the last.
Yep.
Conduct more statewide trainings. We need to get the word out to people with disabilities, to employers, to the general public. We need to continue to establish the regional information teams to provide disability expertise, and we need to organize another emergency preparedness conference. Our 2005 conference was the first of its kind in this state, and it was wonderfully successful, wonderfully successful. People actually started to talk. They started to dialogue, and we started to discuss many of these issues and how to resolve these issues.
Okay. Margot, too, we want to hand out, before we go into our final legislative initiatives, we've got part of our toolkit, and it's not quite done yet, but we do have our whistles. And it's, yes, you can whistle while you work, but whistling, we need to hand out the whistles you can, and we include that as part of our kit, because whether one can hear the whistle or whether
you'll each be receiving.
Right. It's one way, you know, it goes back to that Titanic, when she was floating out there, and she sees the guy with the whistle, and she takes it and blows it, and that's how they hear that she is floating out there in that cold water. So I would encourage you, keep a whistle wherever you are, because somebody will be able to hear you if you are somewhere where they're trying to get out. So what's needed legislatively for initiatives from our perspective? Clear directives that mandate state agencies involved in emergency response initiatives to work with state disability agencies. There's more than just us, and we work with a variety of the different disability agencies. Dedicated staff time to assist in the development of emergency plans, work across agencies, and educate the public. As you heard earlier when I gave you a brief overview of our agency, we work on numerous issues. And a lot of it's on Margot's plate here. So, and we continue to do this without additional appropriation or funding. And certainly we seek additional funding, but I just need to mention that because it is vital here as all of our state agencies continue to do more and more. And also provide funding for development and implementation of another statewide conference, as Margot said. We really need to do another one of those because we keep getting asked, and it's kind of hard to do with our limited funding structure. And, of course, transportation. Currently going through the legislature right now is a bill on Senate File 2695 and House File 2943 that looks at statewide transit, implementation of this transit system that will really impact everyone, not only people with disabilities and seniors, but it will impact everyone. So I'd urge everyone to support that because this is just a step to make sure we are all able to get where we need to be and even in an emergency. So this really concludes our presentation. Again, we just really want to emphasize that people with disabilities need to be at the table talking and planning, and we want to be a part of the solution, and I think we can be. So we thank you for letting us come share all of our knowledge and our issues here, and if you have questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Questions from the committee? Ms. Cross?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I just have a little example I want to leave you with, and it's in there was a mass dispensing exercise in southern Minnesota in one of the smaller towns. But it a community with a significant number of seniors and people with disabilities. And I was at a conference, and I was talking to the individual who was responsible for that mask dispensing exercise. And we were talking, and being an accessibility specialist, of course, my very first question was, well, how accessible was the site? And if I could have captured the look on his face, because a very nice man, you know, one of the nicest men I've ever met, concerned about everything, but he hadn't thought of it. It hadn't even crossed his mind. And yet, that community had such a significant number of disabled and senior citizens. I could see that within a very short time, there would have been a bottleneck. There would have been, you know, some chaos, because it's like, what do we do? Because everybody had to go up a flight of stairs in order to get what was needed. So, I mean, it's something that is so basic, but yet so forgotten. Unless it's brought home time and time and time again. And I think we serve such a critical purpose by reminding people that we are there, that we're part of the community, and we're not just a burden for the community. You know, everybody says, oh, people with disabilities, we'll get to them eventually. I want you all to know that one of the most sophisticated shortwave radio systems in this state is operated by people with disabilities. So it may be that someday when our communication systems are encountering some sort of a breakdown, you may have to come to us. And I kind of like that idea, but I think we can all work together, and I think we can make whatever systems we have in place much more responsive and to all of our populations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cross. Mr. Forte?
I'd just like to say I apologize, but I'm going to have to leave. Chrissy Rowagon is my assistant. She can handle any questions. The other point I'd like to make is ECHO's coming up next, and Minneapolis works very closely with Lillian McDonald, and we totally support this program. I wish I could be here to comment on it, but I do have some political things I have to do in Minneapolis.
Okay.
I apologize.
Thank you for your testimony, and next we'll call Lillian McDonald. If you can state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony, please. And Ms. McDonald, I'm sorry if I don't know how long a presentation you have. We are trying to wrap it up by 11:30, and we can go a couple minutes over, but we probably have about 12 minutes or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and the working group. I'm aware of our time limit, and I have adjusted the PowerPoint presentation to shrink this down into a heartbeat for you. I want to tell you that, and I would like to suggest to you, if you don't have this already on your agenda, all of the ideas expressed today by not only my colleague presenters but also members of this work group are great. One critical key glue that I guarantee you must be in place in order for any plan to work is communication. You cannot expect the general public or the internal people who are working together to carry out these plans to do so, get medicines, handle their losses, deal with their families, and their emergency response without the ability to successfully communicate this information. So if you don't already have on the agenda in the future, I would suggest to you that you devote a session to just how will we communicate in a crisis. I have more than 20 years in broadcast media, 5 years in public health, and left to work with public health and safety agencies on emergency communication. And out of their need to be able to reach the public to tell them where to go to get medications or help and carry out the appropriate process was born a program called ECHO, Emergency Community Health Outreach. And this program essentially fills a niche for a population that has in many ways gone undeserved or underserved in terms of how they will get information in a crisis. If there is a pandemic influenza or disease, there is no county boundary. There is no cultural boundary. We will all be affected by this. ECHO's goal has basically one mission, and that is to develop emergency and educational health and safety information for a unique population that we already rely on to deliver goods and services in our communities, and we will rely on to help us react in a crisis as well. And I'm talking about limited English proficiency populations. ECHO created a model, and I dare say it may become a national model in the future. It's our hope, where how will we get information out to the public and not just the English-speaking public? We created a model much like the mainstream model that's already out there. We will need the media to get information out, whether it's to evacuate, to put out the fire, to where do you go to get your mass dispensing drugs, what do you do if we have multiple deaths, et cetera, et cetera. Communication will keep communities together, and if we don't have a system set up in place that addresses all languages, the messages will not get out to all people. ECHO has this multimedia model. We use public television and cable stations. We use a toll-free phone line. We have a website. We also have an extensive or an ongoing partnership face-to-face network that we're working through in the state of Minnesota. We're new. We also recognize we need public and private partnerships because it's not just about money. A lot of this work in an emergency will come down to people. So in breezing through, if you will, my comments, we're talking about bringing together populations and resources and experts to get to the heart of how do we communicate about saving lives in a crisis. There are many members in this limited English proficiency population here in Minnesota who are already sitting at the table with ECHO and with you and with health and emergency responders, standing ready to work together to solutions and how to communicate that information to their populations through clan leaders, through mosques, through other organizations. Our statewide model that we're using right now with public television, because we know the mainstream networks will not even touch this area of limited English proficiency populations. There's no money in it. There's no money in it on a day-to-day basis. And in a crisis, it's about getting the message out. So we're working with public television. We pay them to help us deliver our messages, to brand our health and safety messages in our communities as best we can every month. We do regular health and safety information. What's resonating with these populations is how to get jobs, how to get my kids through school, health prevention, and emergency preparedness. We can learn a thing or two from these populations. They already have national inoculation days in many of these countries. So mass dispensing is a no-brainer for many of these populations. By bringing them together with our government experts, I really do believe we can create a common message that saves all. So we're delivering some of these messages now by branding ECHO in these communities as their go-to information resource for health and safety information. And we're doing that on public television. Just this year now, we're going out statewide with a monthly message in six different languages: Spanish, Hmong, Somali, Lao, Vietnamese, and Khmer. I'd show you a sample, but I'll save it for next time. Everything we do on television as a cost-saving measure and an information resource is provided on our worldwide website, echominnesota.org. So information that we'd already put on television, we just simply duplicate it and put it on the web as well. DVD distribution has gone up dramatically because these cultures want the information. Our health providers are putting the information in clinics. It's bilingual. It's open captioned in English so that these populations who are struggling to learn English and struggling to learn medical knowledge are also learning information in the clinics. You can learn about the flu in less the time it takes you to read an entire fact sheet about the flu. In a crisis, we're going to be churning out information on the fly. There won't be time to translate. There will barely be enough time to talk it through. By working with these cultural agents in our communities every month to put ECHO information together, we can hand them information in English. They can turn it around on a dime and get it out on our network as fast as they can. But it will take time to continue branding this and building the capacity to deliver this model, which I'm proud to say I think Minnesota has started. In addition to television and web, we offer a toll-free phone line in 10 different languages. If anything, this phone line may be the lifesaver that lets people know, yes, we are aware there's a problem, yes, we are addressing it, and we will have information out on these resources for your particular community on these locations. People will need to know something. Obviously, when the bridge went down, we knew it went down. But what we didn't know is who was in the water. And we will need to know what to do to help those people, not just on the immediate impact of any crisis, but what it will take to handle on days on end when we're talking about a pandemic. And that's going to take constant communication from multiple resources and I dare say in multiple languages. We are also working through partnerships by understanding who are the Klan leaders, the mosque leaders. Many will tell you they will not evacuate if they hear it from the governor. ECHO is trying to bring together relationships in these communities so that when the governor talks to the Klan leader says, what he says goes. Follow the lead. That takes relationships. No TV station, no radio station, no toll-free phone line is going to be able to deliver that in a crisis. That takes understanding who we are as people and working together, our communities, our cultures, and our public officials. We have one mission, I mentioned it, and that's how do we communicate in a crisis? ECHO was born out of local public health, safety, and emergency preparedness leaders, mostly government, since 2004. We know funding is short, and we know it's going to take public and private resources. So we've recently gone nonprofit to be able to deliver this model because it's going to be all hands on deck at all times. We've just made that turn around the bend. I'd like to be able to keep you informed on this because we know that government will call the shots in a crisis. And it's going to take everybody, again, to come together, public, private. Dr. Osterholm mentioned Best Buy. We hope to have Best Buy at our table, too. We know their communication tools will be very critical in a crisis, so we have a redundant toolkit to trot out and in multiple languages. Why change? I'm happy to give you more details on this. I think in a nutshell, I mentioned it, public, private, funding, et cetera, et cetera. We're housed in the Association of Minnesota Counties building. So we already are building relationships with all the counties across the state of Minnesota. It is our goal to complete one mission, one vision, and that is that on a day-to-day basis, as we learn more and working with these cultures and learning how to communicate with everybody in a two-way process through redundant communication channels, we have one vision, and that is that in an emergency, we can turn that package around in a heartbeat. As fast as we can and across multiple vehicles through multiple languages so that somehow the majority get the message. We poised ourselves through the National Incident Management System. We don't have this together yet. Our plans are not written. Our counties are looking to us as a possible solution. This is work we have to do. I want to be very clear about that. But these are the ideas we are going for. If you want to have a statewide exercise, you're going to need to communicate that exercise. We want to be a part of that in multiple languages through our resources to date, and they're here pictured for you visually. It will take somebody to sign off on that message, to evacuate, to go get resources, to go and get your medicine. And then from there, ECHO's goal will be to try to provide that information in multiple languages for special populations who currently don't get the message in an emergency. This is how we see ourselves sitting at the table with other state agencies in the future as we work toward the collective goal in our mission to be sure that we save lives. That's the bottom line, and that's what we are all trying to do with this working group and in working together, and I thank you for the opportunity to share it.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Any questions from the committee?
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McDonald, how big a staff do you have? It sounds like you've been there since 2004. But how big a staff do you have?
Madam Chair, I thank you for that question. One and one half. I'm the one, and then I have a part-time person, but I am blessed with some in-kind contributions of local public health agencies who borrow public information officer time to help with ECHO. But you are right. I think you're alluding to how do you make this work? We don't make this work in a crisis in the current model we have. That's one of the reasons why we had to move to a more nonprofit-oriented organization. Government can't do it alone. We need to add some staff and some capacity. All of our work now through translation, interpreters, spokespersons, we offer these community members a mere $115 stipend. When the bridge went down, I actually called some of these members and said, would you mind being on call just in case I need you? As a favor to our communities, these limited English proficiency residents in Minnesota are willing to work for free to be a part of the system because they want to save lives too. We're just trying to build the model that will allow them that opportunity so they have a voice so we can work together to help each other.
Mr. Chair, do you receive state funding?
We do currently receive some emergency preparedness funding from a variety of grants through local public health and the MMRS agency, but we've realized a 9% to 15% cut just this year in that funding. Hence the other reason why we're trying to move towards some private partnerships and seek some funding from foundations who believe in our mission as well.
Thank you. There are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Any other comments or discussion, Ms.
Rollwagon.
I want to say wagon.
Rollwagon, if you say it in the vernacular.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I know Rocco already gave his pitch for ECHO, and it is a program that the City of Minneapolis has supported. As the co-chair of the MMRS, or the Metropolitan Medical Response System, of which I am, this is a program that we consider one of our gems, and it is incredibly successful. It will be the national model, I am convinced. And the work and the passion that Ms. McDonald has for this is refreshing, and it should be a part of our crisis management process going forward. And I think she's correct in saying that the nonprofit, going to a nonprofit status and allowing for that ability to seek our partners in the private sector goes beyond just funding. It goes to relationship building and capacity building as well, so that someday we can do that statewide exercise.
Thank you, Ms. Rollwagon. If there's nothing further, we will adjourn the committee. Thank you.
It's so cool. I told this to her yesterday. She put-